all sorts of raised panels and architraves a foot wide, plus window lights running down either side. Peep Gas pressed the doorbell, and everything, the walls, the glass, the door, was so big and heavy, you couldn't hear it ringing inside. Presently the door opened, and a middle-aged black maid in a white uniform was standing there.
"Ray Peep Gas," said Peep Gas. "I'm here to see Mrs. Croker."
"She's expecting you," said the woman. "Come on in."
Peep Gas found himself in an astonishingly, to him, large hall, with a marble floor of white, into which were set, at discreet intervals, black diamond shapes. At the rear of the hall a colossal staircase swung up in a half-spiral to the floor above. The curve of the staircase created a silhouette against the light that flooded in through an enormous arched window behind it. In no time Martha Croker had emerged from one of the rooms off to the side. She was wearing a long-sleeved navy blouse and a tan gabardine skirt. She struck Peep Gas as a little heavy, but her legs weren't bad at all. And this place was lavish beyond anything he had imagined. On the other hand, he also happened to know her age all too well. 53.
"Good morning, Mr. Peep Gas."
"Good morning, Martha. And please make it Ray." They shook hands, and Martha Croker said,
"I'm sorry I had to make this so early. Would you like some coffee?"
"No. Actually, to tell you the truth, some coffee would be great." So she sent the maid off for some coffee and led Peep Gas into some sort of den or library. It wasn't a big room, but every square inch of it looked as if it cost more than the sum total of Peep Gas's possessions in Collier Hills. The oriental rug, the antique secretary at which she seemed to have been working, the fabric on the walls, the bookshelves, the chintz-covered easy chairs, and, above all, a charming bay that was set off from the rest of the room by a parabolic wooden arch and a sumptuous display of Victorian mouldings that surrounded the bay's three big windows. In the bay was a round rosewood Regency table with a pair of upholstered Regency dining chairs pulled up to it.
"Let's sit by the window," said Martha Croker. "It's a nice place to have coffee."
And, sure enough, it was. The windows looked out on a small formal garden, bursting with statacy, delphinium, and peonies, that seemed to have been created especially for the view from this one room. An ancient gardener, a black man, was down on his knees doing something with a trowel. He wore old-fashioned puttees, an article of dress Peep Gas had never seen before, except in pictures of the World War I military. At the perimeter of the garden was a dense semicircle of boxwood bushes, mature ones, waist-high, and grown together and immaculately clipped until they looked like a single fat green wall. Beyond the boxwood was an immense lawn, partly in open sunlight, partly in the shade of huge old trees, and everywhere bordered by carefully groomed shrubbery and beds of flowers. Peep Gas gazed out the window and, without turning toward her, said,
"It's absolutely beautiful, Martha."
Something told him to tuck in as many Marthas as he could.
"It's a lovely time of year for gardens," said Martha. "I can't take any credit for it." She motioned toward the old gardener. "Franklin does it all."
Mr. Ray Peep Gas of Planners Bank's little Marthas were somehow so casual and intimate, pleasantly so. She gazed at Mr. Peep Gas while he gazed out the window. He was nice-looking, handsome even, but in a rather soft way, with a lineless boyish face, perhaps a bit too boyish. How old was he, anyway? A full head of sandy hair, but with traces of gray. Bright blue eyes, but his eyelids drooped at the outer corners.
the beginnings of a double chin. All of which gave her hope that he might be closer to 50 than to 40. Clothes a bit the worse for wear. An appalling necktie, with an explosive burst of colors that had nothing to do with his shirt or his suit. A small faint patch of beard stubble below the joint of his jaw, which his razor had missed. All of which perhaps indicated he didn't have a wife to monitor such things. Not a strong man, obviously. Drunk the other night when she first met him. But friendly and warm. And he had remembered her name. And friendly and warm this morning. Whatever he had come over for. All of which flashed through the Wernicke's and Broca's areas of her brain in a matter of seconds, far faster than it would take to say it out loud. She was now happy she had chosen to wear what she had on. The dark blouse that minimized her heaviness through the shoulders and back. The tight gabardine skirt that brought out her best feature, which was her legs. The tan pumps with black caps that more or less matched the skirt and the blouse. Semi-high heels, just high enough to make out the excellent contours of her calves. And her makeup, almost as carefully done as it had been for the opening at the High, although she had gone far easier on the mascara. And her heavy gold chain-link choker, which helped cover up the lines in her neck.
"Did you have to drive far to get here?" she asked Mr. Ray Peepgas. Which really meant, "Where do you live, and is there a wife there?"
"Not very far, really," said Peepgas. "I live in Buckhead, too, but there's Buckhead." He paused and chuckled and made a little gesture out the window. "And there's Buckhead. I have an apartment in Collier Hills. I used to have a house in Snellville before my wife and I separated." He had a vague awareness, which he couldn't have explained, of wanting Martha Croker to be apprised of that fact. "To tell you the truth, it's a lot easier to drive here from Collier Hills at this time of the morning than it is to drive down Peachtree Street to Planner's Bank."
Martha said, "Well, I'm sorry I had to make it so early. This is just one of those days."
Which really meant, "One of those days when I have a 10:30 appointment at Definition America for Mustafa Gunt's class." "Not at all," said Peepgas. "This is actually a perfect time for me."
"Except that I'm so damned hungry," he thought.
For an instant he wondered if he might possibly suggest that perhaps her maid might be good enough to whip up some pancakes or waffles for him. But only for an instant. Out loud, "I hope I haven't made all this, the purpose of my visit, I mean, sound mysterious or anything. It's just that I'm afraid I'm going a little out of bounds with what I want to talk to you about." He paused, lifted his eyebrows, opened his eyes wide, and gave her a vulnerable smile. "So, any time if you want me to shut up and forget about it, just say so, and I won't proceed any further."
"Well, now you do make it sound mysterious," said Martha.
Peepgas gave a shrug, also of the vulnerable sort. "You remember when I saw you at the museum the other night? I told you I had been thinking about you that day. Or I think that's what I said. Anyway, that's quite true. The only thing I'm not sure about is how much of all this it's appropriate for me to tell you, since it's the bank's business. But it's even more critically your business, it seems to me."
Martha smiled patiently. "What is?"
Peepgas put on a dead serious look.
"I'm not sure whether or not you know about the jam Charlie, your former husband, has gotten himself into."
"No, I don't," said Martha. "The bank would probably take a dim view of my telling you this, but to all intents and purposes, Charlie Croker is bankrupt."
"Bankrupt?"
"Yes," said Peepgas. "The only question that remains is how hard a line Planner's Bank wants to take. He owes us approximately $500 million, and several other banks and two insurance companies another $285 million. Of the total, he's guaranteed $160 million personally. He's also hopelessly in arrears on interest payments, never mind principal.
What happened to non-recourse loans only?
One of Charlie's cardinal principles, from the very beginning, had been that a developer should never accept a loan for which he was personally responsible. The bank's only recourse should be the assets of the corporation. Charlie was determined to build Croker Concourse no matter what, and now he's paying the price. He spent $8 million of our money, putting in an astronomical light show at the top of the tower, which nobody wants to look at lunch in the first place. Now, why am I telling you all this? Because we've begun workout proceedings in his case. Do you remember workout proceedings?
I remember Charlie involved in a workout back in the 70s.
Well, he's in the workout of all workouts right now, believe me. Which means that we're going through his finances with a fine-tooth comb. In the course of it, I've seen the terms of his divorce settlement with you. So I've seen the dollar amount he's supposed to give you each month. And I can only assume it's a significant part of your income. Forgive me if I'm way off base or out of line.
Subdued. No.
Well, what I see happening is that the approximately $7 million a year Charlie takes as a dividend out of the Croker Global Corporation is no longer going to be there. We've already seized his Gulfstream 5, and we're probably going to go after Turpentine next. And there's no way his creditors are going to let him take $7 million a year out of this drowning corporation of his.
Good Lord, said Martha.
She seemed genuinely shocked by the whole business.
If he loses Turpentine, he'll absolutely die.
If I may be frank about it, said Peepgas, I don't particularly care what happens to Charlie and Charlie's plantation. My concern is the effect all this might have on you. I thought that at the very least you ought to know about it, even though, as I say, I don't know what my own superiors would think of my coming here and telling you all this. What worries me, or what you might want to think about, is that Charlie is going to be lucky if he takes $300,000 a year out of Croker Global, much less the $600,000 a year he's supposed to give you under the terms of the settlement. And if he keeps on with the hard-nosed, uncooperative attitude he's been giving us so far, he could wind up with nothing. Every single asset he possesses, right down to his cufflinks, if he wears cufflinks, I don't recall, everything he's got is on the line. I just thought somebody ought to give you at least the rough outlines of what's been happening. Martha Croker didn't say anything at first. Peepgas studied her face. She must have been a very pretty woman back when Croker married her. She was a very handsome woman, even now. But the lines in her face had begun to creep down over her jawline, the better to hook up with the lines in her neck. And yet, what a chain of gold there was around that neck! He wondered if it was real gold. Well, why shouldn't it be? The lawn, the gardens, the gardener in puttees were all real. Just then the black maid, Carmen, arrived with a tray, a silver tray with gadrooned edges, upon which were not only an ornately wrought little silver coffee pot with an eccentric ivory handle — Peepgas had never heard of Georg Jensen silverware — and two sets of outsized bone china coffee cups and saucers. The saucers had handles designed in flamboyant swoops, and a silver sugar bowl and creamer that matched the coffee pot. Viscerally, he could sense how much the sugar bowl, a mere sugar bowl, must have cost, which was, in fact, $1,250. But also a silver bread gondola, from which
beneath a covering of damask napkin, came the most delicious aroma of hot bread. Or was it possibly cake? An aroma that proceeded straight from Peepgas's nose to the aching, starving void in his stomach, exciting that organ in a delirious way. He wanted to reach out and pull back the damask napkin and get at it, but he restrained himself. Meantime, the maid poured the coffee. Another ecstatically rich aroma. Martha Croker said, "Thank you, Carmen," adding the sort of warm smile that, as Peepgas had already observed, Southern women used to show their guests how considerate they were of their help. Then she folded back the damask napkin on the bread gondola, and there they were, thick, rich, cake-like slices of a sort of bread Peepgas had never seen before.
"Please, have some Sally Lunn, Ray."
"Ray," she had called him, out loud.
"Sally Lunn?" "It's a Virginia recipe," said Martha. "No one I know has ever made it any better than Carmen."
This loud enough for Carmen, who was heading out of the room, to hear.
"I'm not even going to tell you what's in it. I think it's wonderful with damson preserves."
She motioned toward the little crock on the table. Peepgas didn't have to be told twice. He took a thick slice of the bread, which was still warm to the touch, and spread on some margarine and the preserves, which had tart pieces of plum skin that gave it a wonderful tactile quality, and took a big bite. It was wonderful, marvelous, the answer to a 46-year-old bachelor's prayer.
"Great coffee, too," exclaimed Mr. Ray Peepgas. "I'm so glad you like it," said Martha. "I get it from Louisiana. It's called Café du Monde. It's made with chicory."
"Chicory? Mmm. Well, it's great." The rich warmth of the coffee, the richness of the bread, the ambrosial sweetness of the preserves, the translucence of the bone china, the sheer conspicuous cost of the silverware, which, he now realized, featured tiny, exquisitely wrought little bunches of silver grapes, the intricacy of the crocheted placemats, which were obviously handmade, the patterns of sharp angles and ogee curves in the woodwork around the windows, the view beyond, the formal garden created solely for those who sat in this bay, the ancient gardener kneeling in the dirt in his puttees to maintain this perfect little vista. The luxury of it all coursed through Peepgas's central nervous system as a sensation, a visceral feeling that played upon a man's sixth sense, his sense of well-being.
"Anyway," said Peepgas, "I just thought somebody should let you know what's going on, since it seems to me your exposure in this mess Charlie has made of things is in a way as great as ours."
"The old boy also gave you $10 million in cash and securities," thought Peepgas. "And why wouldn't you want to roll the dice with a couple million and join the syndicate?" But he wouldn't get into all that right now.
"Well, this is all certainly news to me," said Martha. "You know, I ran into Charlie the other night at the museum. He certainly didn't seem to be in a bad way. He was the same old Charlie."
"Then all I can tell you is that he's a good actor," said Peepgas. "In fact, he comes under the heading of too much. Did you know he bought an entire table for that dinner? $20,000? Of our money? Believe me, that did not go unnoticed at Planner's Bank. That's so typical of the way he refuses to be impressed by the seriousness of the situation he's in. Even after we arrested his Gulf Stream 5, he doesn't seem to get it."
"Arrested?"
That's the technical term for seizing a piece of collateral like that. We took it right in front of him out at PDK. He was right there and yelling about the painting on the bulkhead, the one by N.C. Wyeth.
"Oh, my God," said Martha Croker. "You mean Jim Bowie on his deathbed?"
"That's it, yeah."
"The two things Charlie loves most in this world are turpentine and that painting."
"And he still doesn't get it. There he was at the Lapith show acting as if nothing has changed. The fact is, for him, everything has changed."
Martha's face grew hot and reddened. Charlie in the atrium of the High Museum. Charlie preening about with his boy with breasts, captivating the very people she had spent $20,000 on to bring to the show. To Peep Gas, she said,
"Charlie went through a bad time in the mid-70s. At one point he was paying back creditors 20 cents on the dollar, and they were happy to get it. And somehow he managed to pull out of the situation. I think he thinks he's immune."
In her mind, she could hear Charlie saying, "Hey, gal, how you doing?"
Peep Gas said, "If he thinks he's immune, then he's in for a big shock. We've offered him a very good deal, but I don't think he understands that."
He paused and looked straight into Martha Croker's eyes and said,
"What I'm about to tell you is strictly entre nous, okay?
If Arthur Lamprey," Martha could see his hateful, hunched-over form, "knew I was over here telling you all this, I don't know what he would say, but something tells me it wouldn't be good. But I've gone this far, so I might as well tell you. We've told Charlie he can keep his house on Blackland Road, Turpentine, and his beloved N.C. Wyeth painting, if he'll hand over the deeds to the Phoenix Center, the Moscow Tower, the Transex Palladium, and Croker Concourse."
"Hand over the deeds?"
"It's called deed in lieu of foreclosure. In effect, he just gives us the properties. That way he spares himself the humiliation of foreclosure proceedings and all the publicity that would generate. And he keeps his home, the plantation, and the painting."
"What does he say to that?" asked Martha. "I hope you realize that he's almost as fanatical about Croker Concourse as he is about Turpentine and Jim Bowie on his deathbed."
"Oh, he got his back up," said Peep Gas. "He as much as dared us to try to come after Turpentine. He's going to have a big surprise coming." But Martha was still thinking about Croker Concourse. The very name set off a feeling in her, for it was when Charlie was in the thick of the Croker Concourse project that he had met Serena. She no longer had to articulate the thought in her mind to feel the pain and humiliation. She merely had to hear the name. And the feeling, which was in fact worse than pain and humiliation, which, at bottom, was shame, swept over her in a scalding wave.
"What's the big thing about Croker Concourse? The fact that he has his name on it?"
"Partly that," said Martha, "but mainly because he's always thought it was so clever, so shrewd, the way he put the deal together. People don't think of Charlie as clever and shrewd. They think of him more as a force of nature. But in this case he pulled off something very clever. Not very admirable, if you want my opinion, but very clever."
"Oh?" said Peep Gas. "What was that?"
"Do you remember the racial protests in Cherokee County? The demonstrations and all that business? It made the national news on television for a couple of nights, do you remember?"
Yeah.
"That was all Charlie."
Martha Croker had a tired smile.
"What do you mean, all Charlie?"
"Charlie orchestrated the whole thing."
"Oh, come on," said Peep Gas. "Charlie Croker? Orchestrated a demonstration against redneck racism? That's a little hard to believe."
"I know," said Martha. "That's one reason it worked so well. What happened was, Charlie had the theory that the next big growth in Atlanta was going to take place in the outer perimeter, the rural counties north of the city, places like Gwinnett County, Forsyth, Bartow, Cherokee. So Charlie goes out to Cherokee County, which was all trees and pastures, and he thinks he's going to buy 150 acres or what not for a song. Except that he finds out people thought of all this before he did, and the land costs a fortune because it's already investor land.
"What's investor land?" asked Ray.
That was another one of Charlie's terms. Investor land is land that's too valuable to be devoted to farming or timber, but not yet ready for developing. So investors buy it for a song, like Charlie thought he was going to, and then they just sit on it, waiting for the time when they can sell it for a big price for development. Charlie couldn't believe it. Cherokee County, or at least the southern part of it, was all investor land. He's driving around through these back roads up there one day, when he sees an old friend of his, or an old acquaintance, a real old cracker named Darwell Scruggs. They'd gone to school together years ago down in Baker County. So Charlie stops the car and gets out, and he and Darwell Scruggs have a little reunion out by the side of the road. One thing Charlie always remembered about Darwell Scruggs was that he had joined the Ku Klux Klan back when he was 17 or 18 years old. So he asks him about the Klan, and sure enough, Darwell has organized a chapter, or a cave, or whatever they call it, of the Klan in Cherokee County. It was really pathetic, Ray.
Ray.
I mean, I wonder if there were a dozen members, and most of them were teenagers of the sort Darwell had been when he first joined. But there they were, and a light bulb went on over Charlie's head. He takes down Darwell's address and telephone number, and he waits 3 or 4 weeks, and calls up Darwell, and tells him he has it on good authority that a black group called Operation Hire is planning a march through Canton, that's the county seat of Cherokee, protesting racism and de facto segregation in this old rural county that's practically all white.
How did Charlie know that?
He didn't. He had to find somebody. Now that he'd started the pot boiling, he had to find somebody to put in it, so to speak.
"Now, wait a minute," said Peep Gas. "Are you telling me—this I find hard to believe. But go ahead."
By now he had his elbows on the table and was leaning forward, an utterly rapt expression on his face.
"This is the truth," said Martha. "I pledge you my word. One day Charlie read in the papers that this fellow Andre Fleet was organizing a rally for Operation Hire— against something or other.
Andre Fleet, the guy who's talking about running for mayor.
I think so. I think it's the same person.
So Charlie goes to the rally. He was the only white person there, and he stood out like I don't know what. This big 50-some-year-old white man wearing a coat and tie. At the end of the rally, Andre Fleet came over to Charlie and said, "If you have a moment, brother, I'd like to see you backstage after this is all over."
Peep Gas, leaning forward even more, said, "Were you there? Did you see this?"
"No," said Martha Croker, "but I've heard Charlie tell the story 100 times.
"So what happened next?"
"I'm not sure exactly what happened next. But it wasn't too long before Andre Fleet was leading a march on poor little Canton. And Darwell Scruggs did his part. He had all 10 or 12 of his clan cave out on the sidewalk."
She shook her head.
"Those poor, pimply little boys. They didn't wear the pointy white hoods and all that, but they did yell a lot of racial epithets, which the television crews were delighted to record, of course. And for about 3 or 4 days the whole country was looking at Cherokee County, Georgia, as this vile bastion of bigotry, and so forth and so on. You may remember that Frank Farr filmed his talk show right on the main street of Canton. He acted as if he were doing something so courageous, broadcasting a television show inside this benighted backwater. He was talking about poor old Darwell Scruggs and a dozen children. Anyway, land values in Cherokee County suddenly dropped. Investors couldn't unload their investor land fast enough, and Charlie bought a 142-acre parcel for less than $200,000. Before the march, it would have brought $4 million easily.
So he paid Fleet to march on Canton?
I don't know, said Martha. He never said so. All I know is that he pointed the man in the direction of Cherokee County. Maybe Fleet was looking for some place to have a demonstration. He's in that business, after all. I just don't know.
God Almighty, said Peep Gas, smiling a smile of wonderment and looking into Martha Croker's eyes.
He wasn't sure what it meant, but he knew it meant something big and promising.
Does anybody but you know about all this?
As I said, there are people who know how he met Andre Fleet, because I've heard him tell that story to people. But I doubt that many people know about Charlie and Darwell Scruggs.
A big, loopy grin spread over Peep Gas's face. Martha couldn't figure out why. Peep Gas himself wasn't entirely sure. All he knew was that what he had just learned was dynamite.
Martha said, "Have some more coffee, Ray, and some more Sally Lunn."
"I will," said Peep Gas, taking another slice of the fabulous bread from the silver gondola. While he loaded the bread with margarine and damson preserves, Martha Croker poured him another cup of coffee. Peep Gas took a big bite of the bread, and as his tongue savored the sharp but sweet taste of the preserves, he looked out the middle window of the bay. The moldings around the window were like a frame, and the view was like a perfect painting by Millet. No, Tissot. Or maybe Millet and Tissot. Or maybe some pre-Raphaelite. In the foreground, old Franklin down on his knees, the earth tones of his shoes, his ancient puttees, his old khaki pants, his gray shirt, the faded gray-green Bemberg of the back panel of his vest seemed to blend into the earth into which he was so diligently troweling. Then came a dazzling band of royal blue, pink, and white flowers, then the dense, dark green of the boxwood border. And, beyond that, the big-breasted green lawn, suddenly radiant, almost chartreuse, with the sunlight that had made its way between two tall trees. A fellow could learn to like this.
Chapter 22 Shambodia.
Popolo Lolo, Popolo, grind you brother Mucky, die dead, no make ass, no want beef, pouring gurgling out of Five-O's mouth, as he lay pinned under tons of concrete, and the earth shifted and Conrad could feel himself falling off the top bunk. Huh! Which woke him up. For an instant he couldn't get his bearings. Couldn't be Santa Rita, because he was lying on a floor with a carpet. A filthy carpet, but a carpet all the same. People. Asian faces standing over him and looking down at him. And someone was saying, "Lumlock mung vi na pao pak, Conrad." He propped himself up on one elbow and rubbed his face with his hand. High-pitched giggling. Women. The tiny living room was now packed with people, with Vietnamese. Must be 15 or 16 of them at least. Last night, not nearly so many. Last night. And with the recollection of last night, things began to sort themselves out in his mind. He was on the floor of a shabby little modern apartment at ground level, in a town called Chambly, just outside Atlanta, Georgia. It had happened just the way Mai had promised him it would. He was met at the airport, in the baggage claim area,
by a Vietnamese named Lum Lock, who recognized him by his high-grow baseball cap. They got into Lum Lock's pickup truck, and Lum Lock, a voluble little man, chattered in broken English all the way to Chambly, to a two-story stucco apartment building with a sign out front reading Meadowlark Terrace. Lum Lock pointed it out and laughed and said,
"Better they call Saigon West. Know what they call Chambly? Chambodia."
He convulsed with laughter.
"You in Chambodia, and this Saigon West."
He had led him to the rear of the building, where he opened a sliding plate-glass door that also served as a picture window and swept aside some sort of rubbery plastic curtain. And Conrad had found himself in a room full of Vietnamese, ranging in age from 5 or 6 to 80-something, the octogenarian being a wizened, shrunken woman who sat on the floor with her back propped up against a wall. There was a strong odor of fish cooking. 3 middle-aged men were hunkered down and leaning forward with their arms between their knees, holding plastic deli plates up to their mouths and using chopsticks to shovel in some sort of rice dish. 2 men and a woman were stretched out on the floor on futons, fast asleep. Another woman lay sleeping on the bare carpet, and yet another was asleep on the room's only piece of furniture, an old-fashioned porch glider, which was a couch with plastic-covered cushions set into a metal frame with a big rusting yellow metal armrest at either end. Children were scampering about between the bodies of the quick and the dead asleep, playing some form of stoop tag. And suddenly their eyes and the old woman's eyes and the eyes of the 3 squatting men were wide open and pinned on Conrad. The place was ripe with the smell of too many human bodies in a small space. Lum Lock had put on a stern voice and barked out something, the only part of which Conrad could make out was his own name, Conrad. To Conrad he said,
"Morning, I come back with ID."
Then he left via the sliding glass door. Gingerly Conrad had made his way through the sleeping forms and past the hunkered-down men to investigate the rest of the apartment. All eyes had followed him. No one had said a word. He had had the impression that they didn't speak a word of English and were almost as newly arrived at Meadowlark Terrace, at Saigon West, in Chambodia, as he was. The rest of the place consisted of nothing more than a kitchenette, where some sort of fish stew was simmering, a tiny bathroom, and a tiny bedroom, no more than 12 by 9 feet, with at least 8 or 9 Vietnamese crammed into it. In here the carnal heat was even worse. Conrad had returned to the living room, to the only unclaimed stretch of floor in the place, and lain down, clutching his little traveling bag to his abdomen. The Vietnamese had all stared at him, and he had no idea who they were. He had thought he would never fall asleep, but within 60 seconds he had slid down that never-remembered, deep-folded slope of oblivion. And now it was morning, and the room was lit by daylight that came in through the sliding door, where the rubbery curtain had been pulled back. The room was jammed with still more people. He struggled to his feet. He was terribly stiff, and foggy, almost light-headed. Vietnamese everywhere, standing up, lying down, hunkered down. The old woman had at last gotten access to a futon and was stretched out, snoring. Once more they stared at Conrad, or many did. 6 men were engaged in a loud argument. One of them kept saying what Conrad heard as,
"Phao Khun Wa Thong!"
Conrad smiled at everyone whose eyes he met, to show that he was a friendly alien in this strange place. He had an overwhelming urge to urinate. He made his way through the crowd, smiling as he went toward the bathroom. There were 4 Vietnamese already lined up in front of the bathroom door.
He waited his turn. The bathroom was a mess. There were footprints on the toilet seat. He couldn't imagine why. He was just departing the bathroom when he heard his name called out. It sounded like Lum Lock. Smiling as he went, he threaded his way through all the people. Now he could hear Lum Lock shouting something in Vietnamese. The six men suddenly stopped arguing. Lum Lock was berating them. Then he spotted Conrad.
"Conrad, you come here!"
sternly. Conrad made his way through still more people and followed Lum Lock outside, through the sliding door. He looked this way and that, expecting to find... he didn't know what. "I'm an escaped convict," he said to himself. It was a thought so strange, he said it to himself again. "I'm an escaped convict." He could tell by the light that it was much earlier than he had thought. "What time is it?" Lum Lock showed him the face of his wristwatch. 6:40. Conrad said, "It's early." "Must deal all these people," said Lum Lock. "Must deal you." Between the buildings of Meadowlark Terrace were wide swaths of grass. Six or seven black-haired children were already playing on a little cluster of swings and jungle gyms. Two Vietnamese women, both wearing black pajama outfits, stood by. Lum Lock motioned for him to step around the corner of the building, out of sight of the street.
"Okay, Conrad."
Lum Lock twisted his arms out of his backpack straps and unzipped the backpack and withdrew a cluster of small paper bags, the sort a stationery store might put greeting cards in when you buy them. He shuffled through them. Most of them had Vietnamese ideographs drawn on them in felt-tip marker. Then he came to the one marked Conrad. He opened it and withdrew three items. One was a Social Security card bearing the name Cornelius Alonzo de Cassi. The second was a State of Georgia driver's license bearing a picture, a headshot, of Conrad, and the name Cornelius Alonzo de Cassi. The third was a State of Michigan birth certificate, embossed with an official stamp, bearing the name Cornelius Alonzo de Cassi, born December 2, 1977, to Margaret Stewart de Cassi and Demetrio Giovanni de Bari de Cassi.
"My God," said Conrad, "how'd you do this?"
Lum Lock laughed.
"You don't need know that. Birth certificate. Real."
He put the embossed seal between his thumb and forefinger and gave Conrad a look that invited appreciation of this wonder.
"Now you Cornelius Alonzo de Cassi."
This struck Lum Lock as extremely funny. When he stopped laughing, he said, "Cornelius Alonzo de Cassi died in 1982. Sorry, but you don't get death certificate." This struck him as even funnier, and he laughed and laughed. Then he turned serious. "Now you get a job." He motioned toward the apartment. "Cannot stay here always."
"Where can I get a job?"
"An American? Young as you?
Hey, no problem. Those people..."
He motioned toward the apartment again. "They work in the chicken plant."
"Chicken plant?"
"Very big chicken plant in Knowlton. Always they can get jobs in the chicken plant."
"Doing what?"
"They work on the assembly line. Always they have jobs on the assembly line."
"What do you do on the assembly line?"
With a mixture of words and pantomime, Lum Lock described how some slit chickens' throats all day, and some slit their bellies and disemboweled them all day, and some took their feathers off all day, and some sliced them into parts all day.
"Work hard and very smelly, but I have rule. I help you, then you get work." These people, I tell them they stay inside the building until I give them IDs, and they get work. Cannot always walk around doing nothing in Shambodia.
The term Shambodia made him laugh all over again.
But you, American, and you have ID, so you can walk around. But you must get job. That is Lumlock's way.
Conrad said, Where can I get something to eat?
You got money?
I have some.
Oh, Beaufort Highway, Doraville, you can walk.
Lumlock went on to explain how he should walk down the street in front of Meadowlark Terrace and through the underpass beneath the MARTA railroad tracks. MARTA, he gathered, was a commuter railroad, and up New Peachtree Road to the Beaufort Highway, which apparently was a shopping strip of some sort.
MARTA, he repeated, this side, America. Other side, Shambodia.
He laughed again. So Conrad headed off on foot toward Beaufort Highway, carrying his overnight bag and thrusting his hand into the pocket of his jeans for the reassuring feel of the $700 he had left. The road out front of Meadowlark Terrace was wide, but ran through groves of trees and had the sleepy feel of any rural road in the early morning. Soon he came upon a cluster of apartment buildings up on a little knoll. A wooden sign out front read, Hickory Heights, Duplex Apartments. Three black-haired men, Latinos, Mexicans, it seemed to Conrad, were leaning on the railing of the outdoor walkway of the second floor of the building nearest the road. They checked out Conrad, and he looked straight ahead and kept on walking. Just around a bend in the road, he came upon a little convenience store with a sign above the front entrance that read, Be Quick. And, at each end, featured a picture of a bumblebee with a smiling human face. Front was a pair of decrepit-looking gasoline pumps and a group of six Mexicans, if that's what they were, standing with their hands in the pockets of their jeans. They kept looking up and down the road. A pickup truck driven by a middle-aged white man pulled up, and after a brief conversation, two of the Mexicans climbed in, and the truck took off. And now there were four Mexicans with their hands in their pockets, looking up and down the road. They eyed Conrad suspiciously, and he kept on walking. He figured he must be getting near the center of town. Chambly? Doraville? Because of all the small commercial establishments. Liza's restaurant, which had flowers jigsawed out of wood and painted lilac stuck on the sign at the corners. A little place called the 24-hour Play School. Antique shops with names such as Hello Again, The Rust and Dust, and Antique Junction. And then a small building housing the city hall and the police station. Chambly, this was. Two policemen, big, meaty, white men, came out the door and walked toward a cruiser. Conrad's scalp suddenly seemed to be on fire. He was an escaped convict. For the first time in his life, any policeman he saw anywhere was a threat to his freedom. He was a fugitive. Out of the corner of his eye, he could see that the two officers had stopped and were looking him up and down. Zeus, give me coolness. Give me the will to avoid. He kept walking at a steady pace, eyes straight ahead, shoulders back. He could hear the cruiser starting off and going the other way. What if they had stopped him? He hadn't even figured out what he would say. What would he say his name was? He couldn't say Cornelius Alonso de Cassi. It was too strange a mouthful. He'd say Connie. Connie de Cassi was believable. Looking for work, warehouse work. He'd make sure they saw his big hands and forearms. They'd believe him. He ran his hand over his face. He needed a shave. Needed to be spick and span. An underpass up ahead. But it wasn't a railway line, it was a highway. Once he went through the underpass, he could see the elevated MARTA line, which looked so strange rising up like a massive wall in this little country town. He walked through that underpass, and on the other side, another world. Just as Lumlock said it would be. Ming's Auto Service, Kienge Brakeland, Mingok Travel Agency, Leifan Mini Storage. And now he was on New Peachtree Road, where it ran into a six-lane strip. The Buford Highway. Huang Nung Jewelry. Hong Kong Bakery. Chu Yen Tian Money Transactions. Kwok Kwang Chicken World. Fo Hua Insurance Agency. Kim's Pharmacy. Kien Ge Music, which featured Vietnamese videos, CDs, and tape recordings. Many shops had no English at all in their signs. Instead, ideographs such as Conrad had never laid eyes on before. Thai? Cambodian? Laotian? Korean? Vietnamese? A big sign on a metal stanchion said Asian Square. The cars pulling in, all driven by black-haired people. Asians. Barely 10 feet away, a Pontiac Firebird, customized and painted lavender, nosed into a parking space, and from it emerged three young Asian males with long black hair, combed back but extending all the way down the neck to the shoulder line, dressed entirely in black. Black warm-up jackets, black T-shirts, baggy black homey pants gathered at the ankles where they met sneakers that were black with tongue-like white stripes. With a pumping gait, they walked into a restaurant called the Fo Ca Dao. Conrad was starving. On a corner of the shopping center, overlooking the highway, was a restaurant with a sign in English, Mr. Saigon Noodle Parlor, with Vietnamese characters beneath it. He sat at a table by the window, overlooking the highway. As far as he could tell, all of the smattering of customers in the place were Asian. The menu was printed in Vietnamese with English translations in small letters to the right. He ordered Tran Van 5 different flavor seafood noodle soup, even though it cost $5.95, an appalling sum to someone with $700 in his pocket that had to last him God knew how long. But he couldn't hold out any longer. He had to eat. As he waited for the noodle soup, he gazed out over the Buford Highway. Except for the Asian signs rising skyward on aluminum stanchions, it was the sort of stone, low-rent American retail strip that could be found on the outskirts of almost every American city. Six lanes of black hardtop, bounded by blasted heaths of concrete and hard-baked dirt, studded with low, tilt-up concrete buildings and wires strung with fluttering day-glow pennants. Signs that rose far above the buildings on aluminum stanchions, and every other device that might catch the eye of someone driving along a highway at 60 miles an hour beneath a broiling Georgia sun. Across the road, the Peng Mai Chinese restaurant, but also Collision City and an astonishing array of pawn shops. Pawn car titles. Pawn 50% off gold and diamonds. And still more pawn car titles. Emission tests, beneath which was always a Quonset hut-shaped tan tent, in which you could have your car's emission system tested in keeping with Georgia motor vehicle laws. All at once he could hear Lumlock's voice inside his head. "You get a job. That Lumlock's way." Outside, on the sidewalk in front of Mr. Saigon Noodle Parlor, was a yellow metal box, about waist high, a vending machine for a newspaper, the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. The classifieds. He wanted to go out, buy a newspaper, and go over the want ads at the table. But mustn't do anything to make them think he was stiffing them for their bill. So he paid the bill, then went outside and dropped 60 cents into the vending machine, and took a newspaper, and returned to the restaurant, to the same table, and ordered green tea, another 75 cents, and began going over the want ads. All at once, a wave of fear. The earthquake. Santa Rita. Escaped convicts. Perhaps even my very picture. He started on page 1, devouring the headlines at a furious rate. There, page 11. A 5-paragraph story beneath a headline reading, "Earthquake declared worst in 20 years. He read it ravenously. Long dormant Hayward fault. The governor asks president to declare Alameda and Livermore counties disaster areas. Santa Rita. There were the words. 3 blocks of downtown Pleasanton, the Camp Parks Army Reserve training camp, and Santa Rita. The Alameda County Jail. Demolished. 8 deaths. 20 inmates remain unaccounted for. But that was it. No names. No mention of a manhunt. But who knew? This was just an Atlanta newspaper. If only he could call someone. Didn't dare call Jill. Did he dare call Kenny? Or Mai? He was very disturbed. How did they hunt for escapees? In an age like this, computers, the Internet... Sitting here in the Mr. Saigon Noodle Parlor in the Georgia town of Chambly, now better known as Shambodia, he felt a hollowness that no amount of Tran Van 5-different-flavor seafood noodle soup could ever fill. He lifted his hands toward the heavens and beckoned Zeus into his solar plexus. Not even at Santa Rita had loneliness seemed so complete. At least at Santa Rita... There had been others who, whether they liked it or not, had to share his life with him. 5-0, Mutt, people who, for better or for worse, he saw every day and dealt with every day. And who was there now? Other than Lumlock, who by now probably could not care less and was off with his latest batch of $750 a head illegal aliens skulking into Atlanta, Georgia, from half a world away. What was this craving for humanity, even, lacking all else, for humanity in its lowest forms? As soon as Peepgas entered the room, Herb Richman rose from behind a huge trapezoidal desk, beaming, and walked toward him across a carpet of tango orange and aquamarine trapezoids, and put out his hand and said, "Ray, it's great to see you." Ray. What an immense relief that simple exclamation was to Raymond Peepgas. It spoke volumes. It meant that in Richmond's eyes he was still the great banking authority. And social equal, he had been the other night under the aegis of the highly expensive, highly social Lapith opening of the High Museum. Thank God. He hadn't turned back into a mid-level Planner's Bank functionary at midnight. Richmond gestured toward an easy chair with an odd trapezoidal back, and he himself sat down in another one with an orange sunburst tufted into its back. Then Peepgas noticed the walls. 2 of them were curved into waves. Not only that, they were tilted in toward you, as if they were about to fall over. At the bottom they stopped 3 or 4 inches short of the floor. How this was achieved, Peepgas couldn't imagine. But he had heard of the style. It was called deconstructionist. Even Herb Richman's clothes were of the moment, when it came to CEO wardrobes. He wore a turquoise shirt, open at the neck, a white cashmere sweater cut very full in the sleeves, and white flannel pants. Peepgas sank back into the eccentric chair. "Well, Herb, how's Marcia?"
"Oh, she's terrific," said Herb Richman. "And, by the way, we both enjoyed your note, especially the part about the widows of Buckhead who run the high and the real Wilson Lapith."
"Ah," said Peepgas, with a confident smile. "I only wish I could have been a fly on the wall when they were debating whether or not to put that show on."
"Me too," said Richman.
"You know, things have improved here in Atlanta, but they only make their little forays into the terra incognita of culture when they're terrified somebody in New York will call them provincial if they don't. That's the one thing they can't stand, the idea that somebody in New York might be calling them Southern Hicks." So then they talked for a while about how provincial it was here in the provinces. Behind Richmond's trapezoidal desk, Peepgas noticed for the first time, was an immense slab of slate, 2 or 3 inches thick, framed in walnut. Chiseled in high relief was a map of the United States with orange and aquamarine pegs representing Definition America fitness centers all over the country.
"I just noticed that," said Peepgas, nodding toward the huge map.
"There must be hundreds of them."
1,112, said Richman. "We're opening new ones at a rate of 125 a year."
"Amazing," said Peepgas. "Looks like there's no limit."
"I wish that were true," said Richman. "In this business you're always limited by the threat of a collapse in taste."
"Taste?"
Peepgas mostly just listened as Herb Richman delivered some mildly cynical observations about the current mania for exercise, one that Definition America's founder and CEO obviously had never succumbed to.
"But currently," Richman said, "more than 20% of adult Americans follow some sort of exercise regimen, or tell themselves they do."
Peepgas saw that as a good opening, so he said, "Well, our friend Charlie Croker has his own ideas when it comes to exercise."
"Oh?"
"Yowza, yowza," said Peepgas. "Atlanta Magazine did a piece about him, and they asked him what sort of exercise regimen he followed. And so he says..." Peepgas decided to try his Croker mimicry again, since it seemed to have gone over well at Planner's Bank. "He says, 'Who the hell's got time for an exercise regimen? On the other hand, when I need some firewood, I start with a tree.'"
Richman laughed and said, "That's Croker, all right. I'm sure he thinks he leads the natural life."
"I heard you telling Julius the other night,"
our pal Julius,
"you'd spent a weekend at Croker's plantation. How'd you happen to do that?"
"Oh, I hardly know the man, but he invited me. I'm pretty sure I know why. He probably knows we need more space, and he's having trouble leasing that Croker concourse of his."
"I'll say he's having trouble," said Peepgas with a knowing grin.
"Anyway, I'm glad I went," said Richman. "He's a certain type of Southerner you hear about, but you can't really appreciate unless you see him up close, on native ground, as they say. He has this," he shook his head, "thing about Southern manhood. He hasn't got the first clue that this happens to be the beginning of a new century. He thinks he's a great patron of the African Americans who work on his plantation. You should have heard the way he brought his butler out and made him recite to the whole dinner table all the ways old masses helped him and his children out. He shook his head again. "You had to be there to believe it. It was all so patronizing. You also had to hear him on the subject of gay rights."
"Gay rats," he pronounced it.
"Him and this old buddy of his, Bass, his name was."
"Billy Bass," said Peepgas.
"He's a developer, too, and he's also borrowed a lot of money from Planner's Bank. But he's paid his back."
"And Croker?"
"Croker is one of those debtors. Incidentally, we never use the word debtor until a loan has stopped performing. Croker's one of those debtors who are so egotistical, they just can't bring themselves to recognize the obvious. He's hanging off the edge of a cliff, right? And he doesn't seem to know it. We could force him into bankruptcy any time we wanted to, like that, he snapped his fingers. But there are a number of reasons why that would not be to our advantage. Anyway, the biggest fiasco of all is this Croker concourse of his. He spent $175 million of our money on the damn thing, and that loan wouldn't perform right even if he were able to lease it up fully at the top dollar in the current market, which he can't. Herb Richman's mouth opened and remained that way, as if he were struggling to find the right words. Finally, he said,
I don't see... How could you lend him that much money?
Surely you must have some system of internal controls, some way of going over a developer's plans and estimating construction costs in some fairly accurate way. Or am I wrong?
You're right, said Peepgas. But banks get caught up in the boom mentality, too. And that's one of the things I was talking about. One of the reasons why it wouldn't be to our advantage to just foreclose on him. It would become perfectly obvious that we were fools, and that's the last thing in the world any bank wants the shareholders to know.
So what are you going to do? Said Herbert Richman.
Ah!
Peepgas raised his forefinger, cocked his head to one side, and opened his eyes wide as if to say, Now we're getting down to cases. Then he said, My plan, and I've got everybody's go-ahead on this, is to force Croker to hand over the deeds to four of his developments, including Croker Concourse. This is a procedure known as deed in lieu of foreclosure. If we went the foreclosure route, it would all become very public, because then you'd have to go to auction, a public auction. This way, if he just hands over the deeds, we can make our own deals very quietly, which we would want to do quickly because we're in no position to manage a bunch of commercial properties. He paused and stared into Herb Richman's puffy, round face in a searching way. I think I can assure you that Planners Bank will unload Croker Concourse for about $50 million. He gazed even more searchingly. I'm not telling you that as a senior officer of Planners Bank. My superiors at Planners Bank would not be happy about my telling you what a low price they're prepared to sell at. I'm telling you that as a private individual, although I'm ready to help any person or syndicate interested in such a deal. In the process, in fact, I think I would be doing Planners Bank a favor. Herb Richman gave Peepgas a searching gaze of his own and ran his hand through the scarce red hair of his balding pate. I can deliver it, said Peepgas, if there's a buyer. Let's say a syndicate. A syndicate that can make a 20% down payment and has a credible likelihood of paying off the balance in a timely fashion. So we're talking about a down payment as low as $10 million for a property which, in 2 or 3 years, is bound to bounce back up to its true valuation, which is about $120 million. Let's say we're talking about a syndicate of 4 investors, with each investor putting up $2.5 million. In 2 to 3 years, they sell the building for $120 million. Even leased up the way it is now, just 40%, there'd be enough cash flow to operate the building and service the debt, because the mortgage would be for only $40 million instead of $175 million. In 2 or 3 years, you sell the building for $120 million, and each investor gets $27 million, for a long-term gain of $24.5 million. Not bad, huh?
Wait a minute, said Richman. If we're talking about 4 investors, then each one would get $30 million if it sold for $120 million. Or am I missing something?
Peepgas kept his expression as deadpan as he could. Well, at sale, he said, there'd have to be a brokerage fee of 6%.
A brokerage fee?
Yes, for the firm that led the syndicate to the property and put the deal together. Peepgas looked Herb Richman straight in the eye and steeled himself against blinking. Herb Richman eyed Peepgas in the same fashion and said,
And that firm would be? He let the question just dangle in the air.
Arthur Wyndham and Son Realty, said Peepgas. Its home base is in the Bahamas.
Neither of them said a word for what seemed like an eternity. The way Richmond's eyes remained fixed upon his, Peepgas knew Richmond saw through the scheme straight to the bottom.
A new firm? Asked Herb Richmond.
Oh, no, a very old one, at least as far as real estate firms in the Caribbean go. It was founded 48 years ago. Very solid. Well respected.
Herb Richmond was still studying him. Still studying him.
Then he broke eye contact and put on his modest smile again.
I've never run into a situation quite like this before, Ray, but you pique my interest.
Then he stared at Peepgas some more and kept the smile on, and then Peepgas put on a smile of his own. The feeling that swept through him, the feeling that suffused every pore in his skin and made his hands turn cold, was one of fear and giddy elation. Well, he had done it now. He had let the red dog out for a romp, and there was no slipping a leash back on him.
Roger and Farik Fannin's white criminal lawyer, Julian Salisbury, and his black criminal lawyer, Don Pickett, stood in an alcove of the Ringer, Fleesum and Tick library, watching the shaggy beasts slouch into the library's grand reading room. They were the raggediest, maggotiest collection of men and women that had ever assembled here on the 40th floor of the Peachtree Olympus. Their name was the Press. Wes Jordan had been right. In no time flat, the Farik Fannin story, the name of the young woman was not mentioned, had been beamed up from the Internet into the newspapers, which, with toothless courage, insisted they were merely reporting on the widespread dissemination of the story via the Chasing the Dragon website. One ran a pious editorial entitled, Chasing the Internet. Roger was nervous, never having taken part in a press conference before. But Julian Salisbury was smiling and humming to himself and rubbing his hands, as if to say, Lemme at 'em. Don Pickett, a lean, graceful man about Roger's age who truly did know how to wear a double-breasted suit, leaned back nonchalantly against a bookcase, watching Julian's mannerisms with amusement. Don was a dark-skinned man who reminded Roger of the Nicholas Brothers, the great acrobatic tap dance team of the 1930s. He looked lithe and athletic and didn't seem to have a nerve in his body.
"Well, Rog?" said Julian, with a big smile, and holding up his left wrist, which bore his watch. "Looks like it's getting on toward time to go slop the hogs."
With that he gestured toward the press, who were still being seated and assigned camera positions by Ringer Fleesum's office manager, Mercedes Prince. There you had two of the things about Julian that annoyed Roger. He kept calling him Raj. No one had ever called him Raj before, but Julian had called him that from the moment they met. Also, from the moment they met, he had talked about hogs and other farmyard creatures. 3 years ago, Julian had become famous locally by winning a murder trial for a defendant named Skeeter Lohman, with a summation that began,
"The district attorney admits that his case against Mr. Lohman is based entirely on circumstantial evidence. Now, a case based on circumstantial evidence is like a hog. Most folks don't even know a hog is covered with hair, because every last hair on a hog is lying down, every last one of 'em. Anytime you see a critter's got some hair standing up, you ain't looking at no hog. It's the same thing with the district attorney and his circumstantial evidence. If even one piece of that circumstantial evidence is sticking up and won't lie down, then you ain't looking at no guilty Skeeter Loman. Ever since then he'd been strewing slop-trough tropes and sententiae thick as hogswill. Julian was no more than 5'3" or 5'4". So he had his white hair set in waves and puffed up into a 3-inch-high meringue on top, and had 1.5-inch elevators set in his ankle-high boots down below. He had also begun affecting Edwardian dress, with 4-button jackets and shirts with high, stiff, round-pointed collars that seemed to be made of plastic or celluloid. Julian was determined to be a character, and the presence of the press made him throb with excitement. Not so Roger. Shook with trepidation was more like it in his case. Not even his flawless sartorial armor, a new hard-finished worsted navy suit from Gus Carroll, a high-necked tab-collar shirt, and a pale-blue crepe de chine necktie with a perfect dimple, could make him feel secure. He would have to lead off. The three of them had decided that Ringer Fleesum would be the best setting for the press conference, because it had such a grand and sedate decor, and precisely because it was not a firm that ordinarily handled criminal cases. So Roger would be the host. When Roger had